Welcome to Copyright Clearance Standards Podcast Series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It's Friday, October 4th, 2019. Our weekly guest on the show is Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer. He joins me today from New York City. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So it is October, Andrew, and we are three quarters of the way through 2019. As publishers get set to gather in Frankfurt in 10 days' time, the summer sales figures are becoming available. And how are things looking?
Well, mixed, I'd say, which is a word I expect we are going to be hearing a lot through the end of this year. But in terms of sales, it definitely applies. Things are mixed. And I guess we can start talking about the numbers with the good news, which is the AAP's numbers for July, which my boss Jim Milliet wrote about. They saw a big bump. And for the more than 1,300 publishers who supplied data to AAP, sales in July rose 5.9%, with books in the adult hardcover category up a healthy 7.8%. But there's a downside there, too. We should mention that the free fall of the mass market paperback continues. That's been the trend for some time now. And those sales were down almost 20%, just about 19% in July, actually. So, and those are the prime beach reading months. So that's not a good sign for the mass market paperback. Trade paperbacks also dipped 2.8%. But the star of the show continues to be downloadable digital audiobook sales, which were up 17.6% in July of 2019 over 2018. And that's actually a little disappointing. Well, okay, not really disappointing, but it is one of the smallest increases of the year so far for digital audio. In the first 7 months of 2019, downloadable audio sales were up a total of 29.1% over 2018. Really outstanding performance. But hey, you can't be unhappy with a 17.9% increase, can you? And as for ebooks, July ebook sales inched up slightly, 0.5% for the month, but are down 2.8% for the year to date. So for the AAP, at least, not a bad start for the first half of 2019. And it really puts the pressure on the holiday season this year if we're going to actually have a year that ends in positive territory.
And on to another set of numbers then, Andrew. Where does BookScan put 2019 in terms of sales?
Yeah, so the BookScan numbers came out on Wednesday, and you can read about those on the PW site as well. And indeed, they are showing that we are off the pace for 2019, with total sales for the first 9 months of the year down by 1.4%. Now, that's not terrible, though, right? A big book or a big holiday season could easily make up that margin. But the question is that going to happen? As history shows, political campaign season can complicate the book market. You know, there's just less coverage, and people are flooded with other stories. And I think you can say we're in the middle of a flood at the moment. You have impeachment and the first 2020 primaries coming up, and fears of a recession are out there, and potential tariffs looming for publishers that could, you know, end up hitting prices at some point. So not the best environment to launch a book right now.
And as you look at those book scan numbers, Andrew, anything jump out at you?
Yeah, two things really jump out at me, and that's that nonfiction sales are down. They're actually off about 0.6% from last year. That's notable, I think, because, you know, politics books have really been carrying the weight for publishers for some time, and that trend appears to be drawing to an end. And the fiction numbers, too, also jump out because they're down for the year, for the first 9 months of the year, I should say, 3.5%. And that continues a long trend that at some point has to be a concern for publishers, especially as nonfiction is selling fewer units. And at some point, the growth in digital audio is going to start to flatten as well.
Over the last few weeks, Andrew, you've reported for PW and for us here in Beyond the Book about court proceedings in New York, where publishers are suing Amazon over its captions program for audiobooks on Audible. You reported last week on what was a lively hearing, and I understand that this week we've seen a couple of potentially notable developments. Are you expecting a decision soon, or maybe some other kind of resolution?
Yeah, so last week on the podcast, we talked about the hearing at which a group of plaintiff publishers pressed a federal judge for a preliminary injunction to bar Audible from including their works in the launch of Audible captions. And a quick refresher, if you didn't see the story in PW or you missed the podcast last week, the judge was not at all moved by Audible's fair use defense. At least not at this stage, that much was crystal clear. But as I reported last week, an interesting moment came at the end of the hearing when the judge appeared surprised to learn that the program, captions, had not yet launched and that Audible was planning to launch only with public domain titles and in a few select high schools. Well, what's the point of the injunction then, right? If there's no imminent launch with the publisher's works, where's the harm, the judge noted? Why don't the parties just hold in place, extend the current stipulation that Audible won't include the publisher's works in any captions law launch and go right to trial. Well, in an exchange of letters this week, it appears the two parties discussed doing just that and even a potential settlement, but there doesn't appear to be a meeting of the minds here. So Audible has proposed a 30-day truce and settlement talks to be overseen by a magistrate appointed by the judge. The publishers, in response, said they would have agreed to go to trial like the judge suggested if Audible would have agreed to the relief they requested in their proposed injunction, which basically is to keep the publishers' works out of captions. So how is this all going to shake out? Don't know. We may know as soon as today how the judge feels about all this, but it strikes me that both sides are gambling a bit, waiting to see how the judge might come down on the injunction before getting really serious about a settlement. And why not? I can understand why. Since Audible doesn't plan to launch with the publisher's works, why not see if you can win the injunction? Why not see what happens here first? And if you're Audible, why not see if you can defend against the injunction? So, I'm not sure how the judge is going to see all this. I personally feel like she'd probably like to avoid a ruling here if she can. And if there is no harm, why not try to get these parties to get into a settlement or to talk settlement? But I just don't know what the next step is here. I do know that she's going to decide soon enough. So stay tuned.
Also in federal court this week was a mixed decision on net neutrality. Tell us why that's important.
Yes. So a federal court this week delivered a mixed decision in a key court case, which was, of course, Mozilla versus the FCC, that sought to undo the FCC's repeal of net neutrality. There's more to come in the net neutrality fight, but the long and short of this decision, I think this decision is pretty much a loss. It is a mixed ruling, but in my opinion, it's bad news. In the 2-1 ruling, an appeals court basically upheld the FCC's controversial decision to reclassify broadband as an information service, in essence meaning that internet service providers are no longer going to be treated like a utility, like phone service, for example. And that sort of paves the way for these providers to throttle speeds, block websites, or charge more for faster services or other content, premium content, for example. As you know, this is an issue for the publishing community, even though the publishers have yet to weigh in on this in any organized way. I should point out that the Authors Guild and the library community have weighed in favor of keeping net neutrality protections. They all note that giving the people who own the pipes the power to sort of decide what goes through the pipes is not a very good idea, especially now with cable companies that are competing with entities like Netflix or Amazon, for example, with their own streaming platforms. And if you don't see where this might affect publishers in the future, I'll give you one guess where it could easily affect a big growth area for publishers.
Maybe digital audio?
Digital audio, yeah. And to some extent, ebooks as well. But, streaming is still a ways away for publishers, but you can easily envision a world where a startup audio or ebook provider is going to be subject to caps that a firm like Audible or Amazon might negotiate away for their users. That may not be happening at the moment, but as this is a growing area for publishing and digital is a growing area for publishing, it's certainly on the table in a world where ISPs can pick and choose what content is communicated through their systems.
So then why is the decision mixed?
Well, it's mixed because the court also held that the FCC couldn't block states from imposing their own net neutrality restrictions. And in fact, 29 states have already moved to do so, including California, which has actually passed a law that's adopting stronger protection rules than the FCC's net neutrality rules previously mandated. In its report, the New York Times said that that part of the decision raises the prospect, and I'll quote the Times here, that the long-running battle over how best to regulate the infrastructure of the internet will move to state houses around the country. Now, I'm going to weigh in on a few things here. First, I take issue with the New York Times characterization of net neutrality being a long-running battle over the infrastructure of the internet. In fact, net neutrality rules have been popular for years. The rules were only codified in 2015, that much is true, but they've been in practice since the Bush administration. And in that time, we've seen rapid, steady growth in the telecom sector. The rules were not burdensome on the telecom industry. So what I'm saying is that we should call this what it is, which is not a battle, not some debate about ideas, but it's an attack funded by a specific industry lobby. And second, if the battle does indeed shift to the state houses, that has to be a potential nightmare for the telecom industries, right? Who would now have to spread their lobbying efforts across 50 legislators rather than dealing with one set of rules in DC. The regulated their conduct, I think, in retrospect, they will see in a fairly reasonable fashion. But then again, for the telecoms, that would be a problem of their own making. So not a lot of sympathy from me on this. If this comes back to haunt them, well, they deserve it. But I am concerned that the results in the state houses here could play out for years. They could take years in the courts to sum up, or even in the legislatures to finally, move anything ahead. And, you know, that could end up in the end balkanizing internet access from state to state. So, my perspective is, I think it's fair to say that leaving something as important as the internet and internet policy subject to state borders, probably not the best idea. Which raises my final point for today, and that's Congress. Congress really needs to fix this. And in 2017, the House passed the Save the Internet Act, which would have fully restored those 2015 net neutrality rules. The Senate also approved a motion that would have, by 52, they had 52 votes in the Senate, I believe, that would have restored the FCC's net neutrality rules. But, you know, you'll never guess what happened once that passed the Senate.
Well, you're making me guess a lot on today's episode, Andrew. I got one right the first time. Let me see if I could do that again. So what might have held that up? Could it be that the House bill was blocked in the Senate by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell?
Two for two. Yes, indeed. Trump would have vetoed it anyway, so you have to wonder what a big deal that is. But yes, Mitch McConnell blocked that bill from going forward in the Senate. So I guess my point is that you can add one more issue to the 2020 election, and that's net neutrality.
Well, that's getting to be a long list. Andrew Albanese of Publishers Weekly, thanks for joining us today on Beyond the Book. We will speak with you again next week.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up next on Beyond the Book, Bookworks, an exhibition currently on at Tufts University Art Galleries in Medford, Massachusetts, outside Boston, considers bookmaking as a distinctive art form and questions the structure, function, and value of printed matter in the 21st century. According to Dina Deitch, director and chief curator, the nearly 90 works on display show books as material objects, as containers for sequences of thoughts and expressions, and as the ground on which to build communities.
In its very basic structure, the book is a gathering of ideas, a gathering of pages, words, concepts. But then not only that, but the book's great contribution to human knowledge is that it's a way to circulate information. So not only does a book sort of gather ideas together, but also develops a community in and of itself of shared readers.
Reading into the Tufts Bookworks exhibition, available Monday on Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.